welcome to this week's episode of the Movie Breakdown. This week, we are looking at 1982's second highest grossing film of the year. That is Tootsie, starring Dustin Hoffman, Jessica Lange, Terry Garr, Dabney Coleman. The list goes on. So we're here to talk about that film, and we're very excited. I'm Scott Martin.
And I'm Christopher Spicer, and we are all in on Tootsie. But before we do that, I want to just thank the awesome feedback that we got this week. We'd asked people, what do you think about our new format that we're going to kind of go all in on one movie? And we tried it with Goonies, and it seems that me and Scott were really lucky and really smart that we started with Goonies, because there seems to be a lot of Goonie fans. And so a lot of people tuned in and stuck with the episode, and people basically were telling us that they love the idea that we sort of have one movie to focus on, because it allows us to really dig deep and do a lot of insight, and allows more time for banter. And it was, and I appreciate hearing people say they'd like to hear us banter, they'd like to hear us sort of give our insight and thoughts on this film. And they also, a lot of people just said that they really love the fact that it gives more opportunities for diversions and rabbit trails, because I guess that's the thing that people like in podcasts. So we're always good to hear that, because if anyone's listened to any of our closings, diversions and rabbit trails is a thing that we excel at. I was thinking about this week, though. It's really that fine line, because I also remember your dad once saying that what he likes about our show is we get right into it and we don't waste time talking. And so there is that fine line of, I think, a podcast, you want to have those rabbit trails, you want to have those extras, you want your personality to come in, but you don't want to go so much that you forget the focus. And so I think the feedback I got is we did a pretty good job of balancing both, where it's the personality, it's those diversions, but we actually stuck to Goonies as much as we could.
Yeah, I think I'm wondering if my dad, love you, Dad, thank you for listening. I wonder if he was listening in 2014, though, as far as, you know, getting right to the point, because we spent a good portion of that year not getting to the point.
No, well, there's a lot that Sepp Blatter was doing.
A whole lot of Sepp Blatter.
But yeah, it's that interesting thing of trying to find that balance, because I feel that there is some people that I think like a quick get in and get out kind of podcast, but a lot of others kind of like that sort of more friendly banter. And I just want to say how much I appreciate the several people that got back to us, and I'm really happy that there wasn't one person that at least told me that they didn't like this new direction. All of them basically told me they're excited. They almost think this is a better way to go, and made me think, oh, maybe we should have done this a few years ago.
Well, and you know, as going from Goonies, you know, as one big well-known film, you know, kicking it into Tootsie, staying in
now,
the...
Now, before we go to Tootsie, I do want to say, because I should have said it last week, before we started the show, I was about to say something about Goonies, and then I was like, oh, I'll save it for the show, then I never mentioned it. One of the things I really liked about Goonies, and I did mention how I liked that they talked like kids. Like, one of the strengths of Goonies is it sounded like 12-year-olds or 10-year-olds or whatever they were. It sounded like young kids. And one of the things that I dug was, instead of ever saying treasure, they always said the rich stuff. Because to me, that just sounds like something a kid would say.
Yes.
They wouldn't remember what it is. They just knew it was the rich stuff.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I never even, as I told you when you mentioned that, I didn't even notice that when I was watching Goonies.
Yeah, if you ever rewatch Goonies, you will notice they never say treasure. They say the rich stuff, like, throughout the movie. One Eye Willie's rich stuff. And that was actually one other thing. We did mention how we felt like it's not like a normal family movie. But also, like, stuff like that is definitely appealing to kids, but how it has a bigger edge than anything would do today. And we mentioned the swearing, but another thing that I sort of forgot to mention, I realized there's a bullet hole in, like, an agent's head that's in this movie. A dead body falls on a kid. The kids' lives are constantly in danger. and all those type of things, like that level of violence, threatening to put a kid's hand in blender. You wouldn't see any of that today. So that was another thing that I just wanted to bring out of, like, how much it's more edgier than today's movies.
And I need to say, I got clarification. I know I'd said that I thought I'd seen it in the drive-in. I didn't. I saw Goonies in the theater. So I'd gotten that one wrong. But I think I saw Tootsie in the drive-in. I think. It makes sense to me.
Was that double bill with Secret of Nim?
Oh, that was a great film.
I just feel like it must have been with something very childlike, but they played Tootsie first.
Secret of Nim is... I want to do that movie someday. That would be absolutely terrific, because it holds up.
Well, it's on my PVR right now, because I want to show it to the kids, so I have access to it. It's just a matter of you have access to it.
We'll have to find out. Hopefully I do. Anywho, Tootsie, this is, as mentioned off the top, starring Dustin Hoffman. It is directed by Sidney Pollack, who's also got an acting role in here, thanks to Hoffman basically convincing Pollack to get in front of the camera again for the first time in about 20 years as an actor. And the story follows Michael Dorsey, Hoffman's character, who we learn is an actor. He is a very talented one. He's a great coach. He knows the nuances of acting. We learn all that really quickly. I think Pollack's great communicating that to the audience. And the problem is, though, Hoffman's character cannot get work, not because he's a bad actor, but because he is horrible to work with, because he's beyond perfectionist, because he argues with the director, and I think there may be some parallels to what happened in real life with Tootsie, but that's the character he plays. So he gets up, you know, sort of fed up about not being able to get work, puts on makeup, wig, wears dresses, and becomes Dorothy Michaels. And Dorothy Michaels is able to get a pretty significant role on a daytime soap, which is called, it's basically a spoof of General Hospital.
It was Southwest Hospital.
Southwest Hospital, yes.
Or Southwest General?
It might have been. Apparently Hoffman did spend some time on the set of apparently Hoffman did spend some time on the set of General Hospital to get a feel of what it would be like. As Dorothy Michaels, he's able to get that role. We follow him as he interacts with Julie, who he's got a, you know, big crush on. She is an actor on Southwest General. She's played by Jessica Lange. Terry Garr plays Sandy, his really good friend, Dorsey's really good friend of 6 years. Dabney Coleman plays Ron, his first time playing a sleazy boss. That was a joke and got no reaction at all from Christopher.
Yes, for those that have listened to the show for a while, we reviewed 9 to 5 a few years ago, and Dabney Coleman essentially plays the same character, and I think that movie came out a year prior, so basically a year later, he digs into it again. Basically, yeah. A sexist sleazebag.
Mm-hmm. So we've got them playing as people in Dorsey's life as well. Bill Murray plays Jeff, his roommate. And as the film goes on, we see sort of a transformation or partial transformation in the character, his outlook. He comes to realize that as a male, he deals with stuff that women don't deal with. He basically starts becoming because he's, you know, not used to being treated a certain way, he becomes a very, very strong female character because he won't put up with any crap on set. And it sort of leads to a good question of, you know, what is strong female woman? Does it take a male to become a strong female? Lots of stuff we'll be talking about, I'm sure. But as all this is going on, it is a very, very funny comedy. There is a lot of humor in here. And
one of the things I do like, though, we'll go on this farther, but one of the things I do like is you mentioned how he changes becoming a stronger female character. I do like that some of the aspects of him becoming stronger was suggested by his friend, Terry Garr.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Which I mean, she is just absolutely phenomenal and hilarious. Like, there are some funny moments in this movie, and then there are some funny moments in this film. I think that the comedy is great, and Chris, you bring up a great point about the influence that the character of Sandy is. Ultimately, what happens is Hoffman has to unveil himself and does so in a very comical way, and
great soap opera. Like, it feels like something that would have happened in a soap opera.
Absolutely, it does, and the film ends with Hoffman back as Michael Dorsey and trying to take the good things that he got from being Dorothy. You know, as a star rating, I you know, rate this 3.5 stars. It's a really, really funny film as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think one of the things that helps this movie a lot, and we'll probably dive into it a lot more throughout the film, but I think, throughout this podcast. But I think one of the things that really helps here is that Sidney Pollack, from things I read, essentially guided the actors in that, don't play this like this is a comedy. Play the characters straight. Allow the situations to be the comedy. I think in another hand, and maybe a comedy director or whatever, they would have cast someone different, probably, than Dustin Hoffman. It helps that you have someone like Hoffman, who's not necessarily a comedic actor, is very much a dramatic actor. Most of his history before this was like Kramer versus Kramer and Papillon and Midnight Cowboy and stuff like that. So I think that helps. But I think in another hand, they would have gone very broad. They've gone very broad with the female stuff, really played up the fact of, oh, look at this guy. He doesn't know how to wear pantyhose. Look at this guy and how he walks in high heels, and really played up that aspect. And I think there was a lot of potential that this film would have gone farther into the farce and farther into the slapstick. And the strength of this movie is the fact that it plays like a drama. It plays more serious, and it focuses more on the characters, and the actors here are very much digging into these characters and making them feel like someone you would actually see. And I think that helps a lot with it not being this kind of broad comedy, and I think it allows the comedy moments to play stronger. Like, they're trying to play like it's actually like a soap. I'm trying to play like more like, how do you respond when you find out this guy's being a woman? I think that actually leans in heavier to the comedy. I think the fact that it is trying to kind of allow the characters think that they're sort of in this drama in real world, it allows the comedy elements to hit you harder, because you're not necessarily thinking that you're in this farce, or you're invested in this character, you're invested into sort of the drama of it. And so those funny kind of comedy moments, like the really bad actor that always has to read the teleprompter and basically is trying to pursue Dorothy, those moments come off funnier because the whole thing has that more dramatic sheen to it.
One thing Sidney Pollack, first of all, that's very, very, very insightful, I think, on your part.
Because what I'm thinking, when I'm watching this, I'm thinking White Chicks.
Yeah, and I was
like, what it could have been.
It could have been. One thing Sidney Pollack said in an interview was that when talking about this, is that he doesn't, and he said he used Blake Edwards as an example and said, I don't have an eye for farce. I can't do it. I'm not skilled at it. And he said, there's going to, you know, with his film, we knew there was going to be no falsetto voices. There was going to be no, you know, slapstick gags. It was going to be played straight. And, you know, it's like at the very end when Dustin Hoffman's character reveals himself as a male, it cuts to the booth, and Dabney Coleman, he just looks at somebody and says, I knew there was a reason she didn't like me.
And, but that's what makes it so much funnier.
Exactly. And it was a moment like that, which is, okay, it's not a slapstick moment. It's just, this character is so awful that out of everything that's going on here, all he can think about is, there's got to be a reason this person didn't like me.
No, it's incredible because of the fact that his show, he's the director of this show. The show is falling apart. It's going off the rails. We're filming this live. This guy's going way off the script. Like you said, instead of trying to figure out a way of how do we save this show, he's just like, oh, finally I got my vindication. Because in his head, every woman wants him.
That's right. You mentioned...
Also, along the same lines, with the teleprompter guy, he then goes... he mentions his roommate, like, does he know?
Yeah. And I gotta say, George Gaines as John Van Horn in that role, very, very limited screen time, but wow, does he play it so well.
No, he plays it really well. I think he maybe would be the one character... I guess you could argue Bill Murray too, but I would say George Gaines is the one that's really the one true comedic character mm-hmm. all the way through, because he's sort of this, I feel like he's got to be based off somebody, like this very distinguished kind of actor in soaps, but also he's not very good and he always had to look at the teleprompter. Like there's something about him that makes me think there must have been a guy that was like this.
Yeah.
And he was obsessed with always being able to kiss every girl in the show.
Yeah. He's great. I mean, mostly I knew him as Commandant Lassard from Police Academy. So it was good seeing him in something.
He's funnier something. Here.
Well, that's the thing. He's actually funny here. And Punky Brewster. I grew up with him as Harry on, or sorry, Henry on Punky Brewster.
Yeah, but and then again, like this movie, it's more about the lines, because like I said, I think because it's played more as a drama and it's very character driven, these little lines hit you. Because there's another part where George Gaines is with the Dustin Hoffman character as Dorothy, and he's trying to win her over and saying, "Oh, I'm this washed up actor," and then Dorothy says back something like, "Well, were you ever known? Can you be yeah. washed up?
That's, yeah.
Were you ever good?" Or something like that. It made me laugh.
Yeah. On the comedy part, what is very interesting in this is, Bill Murray pretty much improvised all his lines, but the really fascinating part is Bill Murray asked not to be credited in the film. He didn't want anyone to go thinking it was a Bill Murray fan. I think that is just so... I think that is very commendable, because that shows a lack of ego and it shows an appreciation for the movie he's in, wanting it to get its own fans instead of just people going to see Bill Murray. But Mitt Murray is hilarious in here. He's does his dry humor. There's a scene at a birthday party where he's sitting down with a bunch of people around him and he's talking about his art as a screenwriter and director. But this is a guy in the scene before was waiting tables in a restaurant. Like but he's speaking as though he's the best known playwright in the world.
Yeah, I love his line where he's something like, "I get mad when people say they liked my play. What I want them to say is a week later, what was your play about?" Like, he's totally channeling that pretentious
kind yes.
of, that playwright, that art house person.
Mm-hmm. And he did it so well.
What I normally do is I watch the movie first, and then I do the research for the film, for this podcast. And I, as people know, I tend to be someone that likes reading the credits, and I pay attention to sort of opening credits and closing credits and just seeing like, oh, have I seen this name? Who's the cinematographer? Who's this and such? And so I did notice right away, why did Bill Murray's name not like show up in here when they're showing like everybody, like there's people who had even smaller roles that are in this opening credits. And so that really stood out for me. And so it was after I did the research and realized like what you said, that Bill Murray did not want to sort of mislead his fans, because at this point he did Meatballs, he had done Caddyshack, and he did Stripes, and those are very much like college movies. Like those are very much kind of over-the-top humor movies, something that would kind of draw in, I would think, the college kind of frat boy crowd type thing. It was those type of pictures he was doing. And so I agree with you, that's commendable that he did not want to, I think in some ways, sabotage this film by drawing the wrong audience, because it wasn't, like you said, a Bill Murray film. This is definitely more of an adult film.
It really is. It really, really is. And I think there would have been a lot of Bill Murray fans that would have been disappointed if they went to it, because the type of movie, the flow of it, the feel of it is completely different.
And he's really just window dressing in this movie. Mm-hmm. He doesn't play a major part. So if you're going to see Bill Murray, you're going to be disappointed in that way too. Because even though you and I are both saying he's really funny here, and he definitely has scenes where you could see a sense of humor, I don't think there's a single scene that he tries to take over.
No. I mean, this isn't somebody who's, like, he's not using a bunch of energy to overpower anybody.
This is not a Ghostbusters performance.
No, it's not. And, I mean, it's just, he interacts with what's going on so well. Like, there's a great scene where, you know, Terry Garr's character, who also Terry Garr apparently improvised a lot of her lines as well, she's knocking on the door of their apartment. So she's off camera. Michael Dorsey, he's off camera because he's, you know, in the bathroom trying to change out of the women's clothes so he can meet Sandy. So it's just Bill Murray relaying information between the two people, basically. But wow.
I love that. I think two or three times the Michael Dorsey character uses "the soap in my eyes" as an excuse not to be somewhere.
Because, I mean, that's a good one. That's a great, yeah. If you're in a bind and you're like, "I'm supposed to be somewhere," there's soap in my eyes. For some reason.
3 minutes, 3 hours late to a dinner thing. It's an excuse was there's soap in my eyes.
Yeah, there's just some wonderful moments in here. Yeah, no, here's a question. Should we just get to the Hoffman allegations right off the bat and talk about that stuff?
Yeah, we can. Just one other thing I guess I wanted to say, because I haven't necessarily did my star rating here. I am 3.5 like you, but the interesting thing is, like you said, this was the second highest grossing movie. And it got massive critical acclaim. I think Ebert put it on his favorite movies of the year. I think Gene Siskel may have put it on like one of the best movies of the decade. I think his top 10 list, or at least it was close. It was like a runner up. And so this was super high praise. The American Film Institute put it on it. I think it was number 63 of its 100 best movies of all time. And so this movie has been mentioned many times for like performances, and it's heavily praised. It got on the film registry really quick at sort of this important picture. I think it was 1998, which, I mean, by that time, they're normally doing older films. So there's a huge acclaim for this picture. And so I think part of me, when I went in here, I was expecting like a stone cold classic, like 4 stars, and absolutely loving it. And 3.5 is high praise, but I think I went in with even higher expectations. And so I think I need to rewatch this one day with sort of the expectations tempered, because I do think it was really funny, but I don't think maybe it... So, and maybe it's because of the Hoffman thing that we're going to talk about, but I didn't necessarily think it was as groundbreaking with sort of the female stuff as I thought it was going to be, maybe, or didn't explore things at the same level. Like, there were certain things that had issues to, but I'm still 3.5, and it still is a really good movie. I just not necessarily going to give it like the classic label that it seems everyone else gives it.
Yeah, me too. And I think that's why I wanted to talk about the allegations sort of sooner, because...
Yeah, let's get into it now for sure.
Because I think it did play a part. As much as I love the idea of separate the art from the artist, we are all human beings and things do affect us and affect how we view things.
I think that had to be it for me too, because no one would have known those allegations in 82.
Exactly. And these were things that happened as early as, I think one of the allegations was early as 1980, where he exposed himself allegedly to a high school friend of his daughter's in a hotel room. Then there's allegations of sexual assault, like physical sexual assault. And so it honestly, when I went to press play, my mindset was in the, well, I'm not going to view this, I'm not going to let those ideas change my viewing, but once, especially since this is about him realizing what it's like to be a woman, what it's like to be hit on, what it's like to be kissed when you don't want to be kissed, it was literally impossible for me to not think of those things.
And can I say one of the things that I think is really bold for a movie like this in 1982, because I'm thinking of something like even in 19, like Working Girl, it was 1988, where at one point Harrison Ford was like, I took a peek while you're sleeping. And that was just like, boys will be boys, you little rascal. And this movie, I like the part that when there was the George Gaines character was very much going on top of Dorothy and not taking no and essentially trying to kiss her and continue to go for her, that the Michael Dorsey character actually uses the word rape. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just, he wouldn't take no, like all that rascal. He actually said, thank you for coming in because I was close to being raped. And that's something you rarely see them going that bold with that term in the 80s. And so I thought that was really bold for an 82 film to be like, yeah, what he was doing was sexual assault, which mm-hmm. normally back then would be more like, ha, like, look, I'm peeking a girl get naked. Ha, I'm going to throw myself on her because, you know, she really does want it. And so I thought that there is some bravery in this movie, especially when you think it's 82 compared to other stuff that came out during that time.
No, you're absolutely right, because that did stand out for me as well when he says that. And I think that is, like, it is sort of looking at those unwanted advances in sort of a more realistic eye than a lot of things around that time were doing. That's what made it so hard to separate the allegations from the film, though. It's, you know, seeing that. And one thing too that happened to Hoffman when he wanted this character to be believable as a woman. He wouldn't do the movie unless he could believably look, sound, and act like a woman. He was able to fool people when he was in makeup. And one thing that he realized was, and he sort of had this moment of realization, was that he could never be a beautiful woman. Yes, he could pass as a woman, but he couldn't be beautiful. And then, you know, he was talking to his wife about it and saying how this realization of, I think Tootsie's an interesting character, but she's not pretty and she will never be pretty. Dorothy will never be gorgeous. And this idea that he's realizing there are so many interesting people out there that I never talked to because they weren't gorgeous. And I saw an interview with him. He was crying years later talking about this. So it is so odd. Like, and once again, these are allegations. These are all allegations. It is, if he did do this stuff, it's very odd hearing someone talk about those things. And yet still having those possible allegations, which, I mean, a lot of them came out in a Variety article where they talked to, you know, the person that got assaulted in the 80, I can't remember, whatever year Ishtar came out, because she was in a sound booth recording.
87, I think.
Yeah. You know, they...
So after Tootsie.
Yeah. And Variety talked to people who she claimed she told, you know, a few years later. They really, really investigated this sort of thing. It wasn't just a he said, she said article. It played with my mind during the viewing of this film, more so the second time, because very similar to Chris, I left a lot of research until after I'd seen it, and then I watched it a second time. And then in the second viewing, it was so hard to see scenes the same way.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. And I definitely had the same weird kind of internal battle with me. There is moments in this movie that I was uncomfortable knowing sort of the Hoffman character and sort of how certain things it wasn't even just that his character was doing it, but the certain way that women were being treated and then knowing the reputation that Hoffman has right now, that stuff definitely sat uneasy with me. But the thing that really kind of tore at me was exactly what you said, is that it seemed like this movie was one of the more important films for Hoffman, and it seemed like Hoffman learned a lot about it. And he seemed that he learned a lot about the treatment of women, and he felt that it helped broaden his view. Like, I saw interviews, I watched interviews, and it seemed legit. It didn't seem like he was acting. It seemed like this was something really connected to him. You also see he mentions the same thing several times, and that's a real sign of something sticking with you, where he was mentioning how it changed his view of how he sees women in 84. He was still talking about Tootsie that way 10 years later, and so it felt like it really did connect with him. But what I was touring with was it didn't change how he actually treated women behind closed doors, allegedly.
Yeah.
But when we say allegedly, like you said, it's pretty solid reporting.
Yes, the Variety article, because I just went through that yesterday, and it's definitely not one of those ones where they're just printing a story of allegations. There's a lot of work that went into things. And I mean, there was even an allegation in that article where they admitted, you know, they contacted people. I think it was on the set of Death of a Salesman, and the made-for-TV movie that came from the play. They contacted people, and in the article they said no one corroborated what was said, that a lot of people said that no, things were okay. So it wasn't an article that sounded like it was biased one way or the other.
Yeah, no, it seems like it was pretty legitimate. I mean, Variety does pretty good reporting. I feel that they seem to have some really good reporters, and I followed a lot of them. They seem to do pretty thorough research. I've done pitches with them and stuff, and they are pretty big on making sure before you do any kind of article that you've got about 10 different sources and several interviews lined up. So they're pretty thorough from my very, very small experience with them. So I consider them a pretty valid source with that type of thing. But yeah, it's just intriguing to see this film that seemed to have left a lasting impact on him. But at the same time, there just seems to be a really dark past. But at the same time, too, I think one of the reasons, and this isn't necessarily a good thing, one of the reasons that I think Hoffman's performance is so good here and Michael Dorsey is so believable is every repetition I've heard, Hoffman is a torture to work with.
Yeah, which
bad, because I loved some of his performances, and he was an actor I liked a lot, but it seems like he's just a dreadful person to work with, and the fact that he had star power, I think, saved him.
Yeah, and in this film, apparently he and Sidney Pollack just would yell and scream at each other, not necessarily on set, but in their trailers at the end of the day. And, you know, Pollack, it's a lot of times you don't hear directors going into details about working with somebody, but I saw an interview with Pollack. He was just, he wasn't saying things in a mean way, but he wasn't hiding the fact of what it was like working with Dustin Hoffman.
No, it seemed to be he was really hard. Even the writers seemed to be really hard. I had a hard time with him. I guess Hoffman wanted to be involved in every single way, but it didn't come off as a collaboration. It seemed more like he wanted his way. Mm-hmm. This is the way we're doing it, rather than working with people. I know that Larry Gelbart has had a really hard time because he has said that he's the one who came up with the story idea, and he wrote the main screenplay, and everything you see on the screen is largely him. But Hoffman has gone on record saying that sort of he conceived this idea, and one of his friends conceived the idea. And so I know that even with Larry Gelbart, he's had a really hard time because it seems like Hoffman is trying to take more credit than the main screenwriter claims is fair. Like he says he basically wrote this. But it seems on the screen level, there was a disaster. I think because if Hoffman kept on wanting things changed and interfering, that there is countless writers on this. Apparently, there's a few uncredited writers like Elaine May and some others. But on top of that, apparently there was so many that they've kind of been lost to time. Like I've read something like there was 10 different people that were brought in for rewrites. And this script was still being worked on when the movie was being shot.
Yeah, and usually when you hear things like that, the movie turns out to be garbage.
Which is, this movie's a miracle. Like, you're right. I don't know if I've ever read about a film that seemed as disastrous behind the scenes, where the lead and the director wanted to kill each other, where they went through multiple directors, where it was, 15 years of, developmental hell, and where this thing was being written on the set, yet somehow it's considered one of the best movies of all time. Which I guess you and I don't necessarily think that, but it has been held up high. It got huge praise. It's a box office hit. It's incredible. How did that happen? Maybe, I guess, an innovative idea?
Yeah. I've got a question for you. Did you think that Michael Dorsey was a likable character at the end?
Okay. That's a really, really good question. And I actually wanted to say that is one of the reasons also why I don't think I can give it the 4 stars, and why it wouldn't make my 100 favorite movies, why I'm more at the 3.5, was I had a hard time connecting with the Michael Dorsey character, but I feel like the movie wanted me to eventually connect with him. I mean, I enjoyed Dorothy, and they pulled that part off. I think he was likable as Dorothy, but the Dorsey character, I had a lot of issues. And one of the things I think this movie did really well was the beginning of this picture, where they sort of just showed these little snippets. They showed him trying to act like he was performing, and then they showed him teaching a class, and they just quickly went through all these little elements. And that kind of little montage did a really good job of giving you the idea of who this Dorsey character is without going overblown. But you got the idea he was very controlling. You got the idea that he was very passionate. You definitely got the idea he was having trouble for work, but part of it is because he clashed with people. I thought they developed that really well. And then when he went to the birthday party, I thought they did a good job of just subtly showing that he's a little bit of a womanizer. He went to about 3 different girls. He basically told another girl, I can't go out with you, because he thought they had lined up with another girl to go out with him. And so you definitely got that idea of him being sort of this womanizer, but not going over the top with him. I thought it was a little bit more subtle. It wasn't in your face like most movies would be. And I think that's great credit to Pollock, that sort of beginning, and then how quickly they got him to then becoming sort of the Tootsie character going into the Dorothy character. I thought they pulled that off really well. And I think the other thing that kudos to Pollock for being the agent, because I think the fact they didn't get along well actually shows on the screen. Because every scene is Pollock and Michael's Dustin Hoffman's character, Michael, they're just yelling at each other every time the scene. You get the idea that the agent and the actor hate each other. And I think all that works. So all these subtle elements, without going over the top, they show you who this guy is, and you know that he is sort of, not treating women the best, and he's a really passionate and person, but at that time it means he clashes with people, kind of stubborn, and you get that aspect to him. And I felt as the movie unfolded, there is things that he learned, and he does create this great relationship with sort of the Jessica Lange character and Julie Nichols character. I thought those things were good. I think he has a sweet kind of relationship with Julie's father, who sort of falls in love with Dorothy, and I thought that stuff kind of works really well. And so, like I said, when he's Dorothy, things work. But the Michael character, to me, at the end, still doesn't really learn his lesson. How he treats the Terry Garr character really bothered me. And it's interesting, because I saw in a lot of reviews at the time, and that never really gets pointed out. But I thought, and I don't know if it was something of the time, or me just being a different person who believes that, who you're dating is who you're dating, and you don't see multiple women. Maybe that just more speaks more to the type of person I am. But I thought he treated the Sandy character, Sandy Lester, horribly, and it really rubbed me the wrong way. And how that story ended, where he just sort of breaks her off, bothered me. I wanted Sandy to get some kind of revenge on him. I wanted Michael to get some kind of comeuppance for the way he treated Sandy. That really bothered me. And because he did that, and at the end he's sort of walking away with Julie character, I would have rather Julie slap him and left him alone. I think that would have been a better ending, that he's left lonely at the end, because I feel that's what the Michael character deserved.
And I think the movie thinks that he's become a better person. I think the movie literally thinks that, but viewing it...
Totally, 100%. Yeah. When the end, but I want to see this... But then they should have did something different with Sandy, I feel.
They absolutely should have.
She needed a better apology.
Or with, you know, Jessica Lange's character basically saying, leave me alone. But, I mean, he wants the woman, so obviously he's not going to respect her wishes. That's... I mean, the movie literally ends with him going after what he wants, specifically. And that... I found that really hard to take. Like, how am I supposed to like this person if he still believes as a male he should just get what he wants?
No, I 100% agree with you. I definitely had an issue with that too. I think that you're very on the nose there, where the fact that he didn't take no, and I think almost it would have been better for him to see her walk away and maybe he gets something in his face where he's saying, like, I'm going to try to do something to win her back, or maybe I don't deserve her. The fact that he continued to force herself on her, you're right. It doesn't seem like he learned anything. Like, he feels like he deserves to be with her. And I think part of the mindset is the fact that this was a romantic comedy. It was the 1980s. And I think a mainstream movie, a studio, felt that you always had to have a happy ending. And in their eyes, the happy ending was Michael getting the girl at the end, because he's the one we were with. And so I think because it was the 80s, there very much was the idea there had to be that happy ending. Watch this. I think the happy ending is him being left alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I honestly, looking at the movie, and like, I didn't like the Michael character at the beginning. I still didn't like him at the end, which I'm fine with. The movie, I don't need to like people in movies for it to be good.
Except
movies.
When the movie wants you to like him.
Exactly. Except when there's this arc that they're pitching you that look he's likable now. Is he really? And I mean, the thing too is, the movie's not aware, because at the very beginning I said pitched as a romantic comedy. I think the movie's forgetting the fact that because he's playing a woman and there's no flirtatious scenes really between his character and Julie, except for a scene where they almost kiss, the movie's forgetting that this actually wasn't a romantic comedy, because it was just a one-way aspect of a person finding affection for another.
Yeah, but I think, again, you're looking at sort of the problem of this being a mainstream movie, and romantic comedies were huge draws in the 1980s. Romantic comedies were massive box office, and so they had to market that way, and they needed there to be those elements of, I think, romantic comedy in order to draw the audience and make it a big hit. And so then, again, a romantic comedy means you had the girl had to be with the guy. So I think... because the fact that this was such a mainstream movie, it harmed, I think, what would have made the movie even better, which is what we're saying, or what at least I'm believing, is that them not getting together. Because you're right, to me, their relationship, their romance, wasn't the most intriguing part of the movie.
It really wasn't. It's it was as one way as John Van Horn's feelings towards Dorothy Michaels.
Like, I did like that the Dorothy character inspired the Julie character. It's the Dorothy character that made Julie stand up for herself. It's the Dorothy character where there's a few scenes in the soap opera where she makes her character stronger and standing up to characters, and that she ends up basically dumping the Dabney Coleman character. Those elements were good. To me, that was kind of enough.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Absolutely. One thing that was...
I do want to say, to me, the ending, there is a few sweet moments. I really wanted the Sandy thing to be held better. That really rubbed me the wrong way that Sandy was treated, and the movie just sort of discarded her. But I did think that the final scene between Michael and Les, who was the one who had an attraction to him as Dorothy and is the father of Julie, I thought that was a sweet scene.
I think that was actually one of my favorite scenes in the film.
And it made Michael look good. That part did.
It did, yes. Yeah, that actually made him look like a good person. You know, maybe that's a similar style of finale with Julie would have been good. Because, yeah, as it was, it just sort of felt... And it felt like it was completely... no longer self-aware of what it was when that ending came around.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that. Quite a bit. I was speaking about how I liked the Dorothy character, and I thought that she was someone that I appealed to. And in a lot of ways, the Dorothy character seemed like a separate character from Michael. And I mentioned earlier why there's a few reasons why this worked really well as a comedy. I think another thing that really made this movie work is how much Dorothy looks like a real person. Like, not a good-looking woman, mm-hmm. but they definitely made her look like a real woman. And again, it makes me think of something like White Chicks or even Mrs. Doubtfire, where sort of there's a little bit of suspension of disbelief where you're sort of like, okay, people buy this as a real person. Okay. I thought it was really incredible, I guess, the makeup, but also just even Dustin Hoffman of how he got that voice down. And apparently the reason why he gave her a southern accent is that he was able to sound more like a female and get the tone better by putting in the southern accent, and that's why he did that. And I think they did an incredible job of making Dorothy real. There's no point where I needed suspension of disbelief of why do these people think this is actually a woman, because I bought it as a woman. And I don't know if any other movie pulled it off. I like Some Like It Hot. I think Some Like It Hot, which also inspired this, is a great comedy. But I don't necessarily think those two people look like a woman in it. Mrs. Doubtfire, you can kind of see that's makeup. White Chicks, not even close. This is the one time where they actually pulled off this concept perfectly.
It's the thing is, it's believable. You're looking at this person and thinking, yes, legitimately, you know, Dorothy Michaels looks like a woman. The way they had to, pull back the skin on Dustin Hoffman's face to, you know, remove any kind of any of his features that would be more manly. I think the makeup was perfect. I think if they tried to, I think the concept of the female look that they chose was perfect, because if they went for maybe someone even with like longer hair or just anything differently, it would have betrayed the fact that it was Dustin Hoffman under there. Everything just worked out perfectly for that character. And yeah, it's legit. It is absolutely very legit.
Yeah, no, everything they picked really worked. I think you needed that kind of hair, because that kind of hair kind of fits with those glasses. And I think you really needed those glasses to kind of hide Dustin Hoffman's nose. Like, I think those glasses were essential, because it looked a lot less like Hoffman. You would believe that, you know, Julie would see Michael Dorsey at a party and throw water in his face, but still see Dorothy every day and not connect the two. They did a really good job making them look like very different people, but even as an audience, we needed them to be different, because I think part of the magic of this movie is you kind of see them as two different characters. Like I said, I like Dorothy, but I didn't like Michael. I think that's purposeful until the end, where I think you're supposed to then like both.
Yes, I think as well in here with the character of Dorothy. I think even like how Hoffman walks as her really hides the fact that it's a male in there. It's a really good performance from Hoffman.
No, it is a really good performance. I think all the performances are really strong here for a comedy. I know that Jessica Lange was criticized quite a bit for her King Kong performance. I liked it a lot more than most critics did in 1976. And then she took several years off and got some acting lessons and stuff. At this point, she had done a few movies. She has a few movies under her belt, more dramatic stuff. But I really think Jessica Lange here, she gives off the radiance and the star power that she still had in King Kong. She's still a gorgeous woman here. But I think she does bring more than just the ditzy blonde character here. I think there is a lot of character that Jessica Lange brings to Julie Nichols, and I think that's really crucial for this movie to work. She did get an Oscar nomination for this, and I think it's well-deserved. I think she brings a lot of nuance. She brings sort of this person who is kind of trying to find her way. She wants that star power, and maybe she's making some wrong choices by being with the director, and she's aware of that, but you get this person who is kind of lost but also has a silent strength, and someone who sort of is trying to work through the mistakes she's made with her life, because she also has a younger child. I like that little character bit with having that younger child. I mean, the child disappears a lot, but I think it does add to the character. It felt believable. She does kind of give that strength of a single mom. I thought she also has a good chemistry with the Charles Durning character. You believe there was a father-daughter relationship. So I think that was really strong here. You've already praised Terry Garr, but I think she's incredible here. And I connected to her a lot, to the point, like I said, where it kind of, at the end of the movie, I was mad that she wasn't treated better.
Terry Garr was just, I mean, one of the first instances we get from her is at a birthday party. And, you know, she's somebody who gets forgotten, and the way she gets forgotten at the birthday party is just this wonderful foreshadowing, basically, of what's gonna her character is gonna go through for the entire film. Terry, she, my gosh, hilarious in this movie, and for the longest while, I was certain that she was in Three's Company, but I was completely wrong. She was never in Three's Company, but I was convinced for the longest while.
So there's a lot of 80s stuff, just not that one. You haven't quite said, so I'm just going to start up asking you now. Were you as bothered as I was with the treatment of Sandy at the end?
It didn't stand out as much. I was more, I think, the treatment of Jessica Lange's character at the end, of Julie. That's sort of more what I was focused on.
I just decided at the very end to sort of be like, she's willing to talk to him. But 5 minutes later, she just tells him to get lost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Davy Coleman is fantastic as a sleaze. He's great for 9 to 5. I think he's just as great here. He's definitely someone who, I don't know if you would necessarily say he's a realistic character, but the way that he sort of views women seems like something that was probably very prevalent in Hollywood at the time.
Yeah, it's got that feel, eh?
And Gina Davis, this is her movie debut. Very minor character, but she has some fun scenes, like the scene where she's basically talking to Dorothy in her bra and panties.
Gina Davis, it's funny because it's always weird when you see somebody before they were big and just wondering, like, why are they in the background? Why are they in the remembering? Oh, that's right, this came out before she became a huge star.
You can see why she became a huge star, though.
Very easily, yeah. Yeah. One interesting thing through my research, there was an article in the LA Times in 1992, so basically 10 years after Tootsie, and the person talking about Tootsie was referring to, on the Laserdisc, how there was, like, some sort of, they didn't call it a director's comedy or director's commentary. They called it intelligent explanatory tracks.
I love that.
Which, I mean, it's just, I think it's neat seeing that, because it's just something that is, you know, everywhere and on, basically on every DVD. But then, yeah, just doing the research and realizing that, wow, yeah, that that technology had a start time. And that's, I think the thing is, too, because it sounds like the person writing this article is almost, well, it's a behind-the-scenes look at the film. And it seems to be sort of this idea of, wow, look what technology can bring us, as far as how we ingest movies and how we do ingest movies now, especially if you have something on hard copy. If you're streaming it, it's different. But would you even pick up a hard copy of a movie now if it didn't have a single special feature on it?
No, I'd probably wait because I knew that the special edition is right around the corner then.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's just kind of fascinating how, you know, looking back in 1992, just reading this thing about something that we just almost, well, we pretty much take for granted now.
No, definitely. It's now, well, I Now I pick something up and I'm like, well, I'm expecting at least one commentary. It's got to be a documentary too.
Yeah.
But now you're just expecting that you get inside stuff on these movies.
The movie experience in the home all of a sudden became more than just the movie, and it became what else is there as far as special features, vignettes, interviews, documentaries, so much stuff that the home video or the home movie scene with the streamers is almost sort of reverting back to that sort of more simplistic era where it's just the runtime.
Yeah, no, for sure. So, like, you expect some more. We both said that we enjoyed the bar scene with Charles Durning, but there was another little whiff that I got in this movie. Like, there's a one part there where Charles Durning says, like, you're lucky, like, if you kissed me, you wouldn't be alive right now. And there are some parts where Dorothy really didn't seem to want to be kissed by guys to a part where, like, he was doing whatever he could to avoid being kissed. Did you get a little bit, because I did, a little whiff of homophobia in this movie?
I did, but I give it a complete pass because it is so much less than anything else of that time. This is actually, this in the regards of homophobia, this movie actually feels very progressive for when it came out.
Yeah, I think for sure that I would agree with that. I think that it could have got a lot worse. I think the fact that the Durning character is still willing to talk to Hoffman's character, the fact that at the bar they still have a conversation, even though he was about to ask this person to marry him, and he was still willing to be sort of in the same bar with him, would be kind of seen as progress.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I think the way that the film tied up the Les and Dorothy storyline, I think that really put it on a very sensible footing. The fact that they could be friends, the fact that they recognized, okay, there was a lie in there, but there was also an actual connection between the two people.
This movie kind of fits into a few comedies in the 1980s where I think there was a wave of these kind of female empowerment pictures, especially in the workplace. The two ones that stand out to me is 9 to 5, which was came out before this, which was another hit. I think it was like the number two highest grossing movie. I think it was just right behind Raiders. So it would be 1980, so I guess 2 years ago. So it was right up there. And then you would have Working Girl, which also was a big hit in like 1988. And I think there was definitely this move of sort of allowing women in the workplace and being more powerful and stuff. And I kind of put this movie in here in a way, but in those movies, it was females who are standing up and being strong. And here, and you sort of alluded to it earlier, is one of the challenges with this film is you've got this woman who takes off. She becomes the hottest star in soap opera. She's pushing this female empowerment. She inspires other women. She inspires this audience. But it's a man.
Yeah, that's the interesting part of this story is the fact that it's... And I kind of look at it like this. I don't think it's necessarily the fact that a man needed to be the one to identify things as wrong. I think it's more of a commentary of women have just become so used to this world that an outsider, it doesn't have to be a male, but it's just an outsider can instantly spot, no, there's no reason that this should happen. There's no reason this should happen. So I think that's what it's about. It's less about just the male idea, but the fact that women, they don't necessarily notice these things because that's just the world that they live in, and things are wrong and they don't like them, but just that's what they're used to. That's what the world is.
Yeah, I think that is the best way to see this movie is that idea that someone from an outsider is exposed and realizing how wrong things are. And so this is someone learning that lesson and realizing how unfair things were. So then he sort of attempts to push back because he's not used to it. And then it inspired other women to realize, wait a second, yeah, we shouldn't be treated that way either. And they do rise up. Because I do think Jessica Lange brings a lot of strength to the Julie character. And so I think that helps. The fact that she starts taking some initiative on her own. She didn't necessarily need to be pushed. There isn't a scene where Dorothy's like, you need to stand up for yourself. You need to be stronger. She just takes the action herself. And I think that's a small thing, but a very important thing. The fact that the women don't need to be told by Dorothy to stand up. They just see her, and so then they follow the lead and stand up. And so I do think this is still a female empowerment movie, even though you've got a male in the lead role here. But I think it's because you just have to see it the way you do, where it's sort of an outsider learns this lesson, and it allows other women to sort of follow, kind of follow the lead. And that's another thing, once again, I just wish then that that the Sandy character got her moment. Because she's not a villain in this movie. But she sort of just gets discarded like that.
She gets, well, I mean, the thing too is, we're told they've been friends for 6 years. And she's always treated like she, like you said, like a villain. There's no affection towards her at all. And I think that's an issue even from, like, it doesn't seem that Sidney Pollack even views her as someone who deserves something nice. She's just a throwaway person that people discard. And I mean, while that works on the comedy level of the film, because they're also trying to make this dramatic, it doesn't work on the dramatic side.
Yeah, no, I agree with that 100%. I guess that's the part that kind of rubs me the wrong way. But I do think that you could definitely put this movie alongside so the 9 to 5 and the Working Girl. And I know this is the one that's held up as a classic, but I don't know if this is the one I would rewatch the most between those three.
No, probably be 9 to 5. Honestly, yeah, if you were to sit those three movies in front of me and say, pick a movie, you'd, like, without even thinking, it would just be reaching for 9 to 5 at that point.
Yeah, so I guess in some ways you could say then that's the better movie or the more enjoyable movie or it hits its tone better for us. So yeah, I was intrigued where you were going to land on this, because like I said, I'm recommending it like you. I'm giving it 3.5. It's very high praise. I think it's a really well-made movie. I think the way that Pollack went with kind of balancing comedy to drama worked really, really well. And I think it creates some interesting characters. I just did not get the classic vibe that I was expecting, because I was so, it's been a long time since I've seen it, a really long time. I remember liking it when I saw it, but I've seen it on like so many lists and it's got so much high praise. Like I said, some of you put one of the best of the 80s, and I wouldn't do that. Not yet.
No, I couldn't do that. I mean, that's the thing. We're still on the, you know, saying that this is a great film. I think it's good. I think it's great, but it definitely, maybe because at the time it was very original, very new, very fresh, groundbreaking, all sorts of different things. You could never watch a movie in the context it came out with unless you were there at that point. So yeah, maybe. Although technically I think we did watch it. I did watch it when it came out. Just totally forget about it.
Well, yeah, like I said, I definitely saw it. I think on First Choice or something. I saw it really young. But I wouldn't have really been aware of how groundbreaking it was at the time, or how important it was, or what it was speaking to feminism. Those weren't things that, you know, 8-year-old me was debating or thinking about too much. So that it would have just been more like, that guy's wearing a dress.
Look at that. Ha ha ha. And I do like the fact that, well, the character of Michael does become obsessed over things like clothes and all that, but he doesn't, it never falls into slapstick, which you had said right off the bat about how this movie worked, because it was never farcical. And I think that really saved the movie, the fact that it was played straight. The fact that he was wearing women's clothing was never the joke. That was not at one point ever the joke. It was more about the situations, and I think that's why it's still a good film.
Yeah, no, that's really huge. They never played the joke him being woman. Bill Murray's jokes were never really at the expense or him being disgusted that his roommate is dressing up as a woman. He never started taking a love to lipstick or any of that type of stuff. They never played up that idea. He never felt himself up. Like, there wasn't any of those things that I feel if this was Tootsie starring Will Ferrell, we would have had to endure.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, that would have been a different film. Oh my gosh, yeah, headache.
Yeah, no, this definitely went a really smart direction. I think that's what's caused it to be endured. I think that's why a lot of people like it. In those aspects, I definitely agree 100%. Do you have anything else you want to add with this?
No, that's about it. I'm already excited to get through the final stuff so we can talk about what's next week.
Next week's a huge one, but we're gonna tease that a little bit longer.
Aww.
I first want to point people to the direction of my website, which is also the home of the Movie Breakdown, and so you can check out things at beyondbalcony.com. It's Beyond the Balcony. It is a place to explore movies, the creative process, and life itself. And sometimes I also get a little bit personal, and I celebrated my anniversary actually on the day of when Goonies dropped last week. And so I wrote a piece about sort of 13 years now being married and some of the lessons I learned. I think anyone that knows me now, I don't tend to just post like, it's my anniversary. Like, I usually try to be more self-reflective. And so I talk a bit about sort of lessons I've learned. Probably a lot of lessons that maybe a lot of people already knew, but it took me 13 years to get there. And so I'm never someone that's necessarily about advice. I think advice is best when you sort of share your personal experience and then hope people get something from it. And I've actually got a lot of great feedback on it, and it's obviously connected with certain people, so I really do appreciate that. So you can check that out if you want. I did a lot of reheats this week, reposted some things that I've written over the long time the podcast. I have a lot of new listeners, so I sort of grabbed some things from the past that maybe people have never seen, so you can check that out. And I will have lots of stuff up this week too, so please do that. And maybe before this year's done, Scott will post something.
Scott just might. I really need to. I've just been the last week definitely sort of obsessing over music recording. That was one of my goals for the pandemic, was to construct an album's worth of songs and music and recordings, and I haven't done that. So I've finally got back into it. So
okay. I need to say about this pandemic thing. It's fascinating because this week things have opened up a little bit in Ontario, I got to have beers with a really good friend, and then my brother-in-law was here yesterday. And I got to have beers with him too. A little bit of normalcy. We did them outside. We did them distanced. We weren't wearing our masks. That'd be really hard to drink beer. But we were distanced, and it just felt a little bit of normalcy to hang out with people. But both of us, both these people I talked to, came to the same conclusion as me, is that after 18 months of this, we are really lonely. And we're really missing our friends. We're really missing people. We're missing people that we used to find kind of like annoying, we not hang out with. Like, I'm at the point where I'd almost hang out with anybody right now. And people that I used to sort of ignore, I'm just missing human interaction so much that I would almost hang out with anybody. Maybe even the person that me and Scott once hung out with at a pub, like, just because I want to be with people so bad. But, at the same time, it's weird where I'm so lonely after 18 months, but because my kids have been home almost every day because of online schooling, because my wife has been at home too, it's this weird thing if I'm really lonely, but I also feel like I have not got any personal time for 18 months. I feel like I haven't had any time to myself, any time to sort of give to myself. So I'm like burnt out on no personal time. And I'm burnt out on, like, not being with people. So I'm also lonely, but feel like I've never been alone. And so it's this weird feeling, and both these guys sort of agreed with me, so I'm not sure if other listeners can kind of relate to that. So as people are getting their vaccines and things are opening up, those are two things I'm looking forward to fixing. I'm guessing the no free time thing, though, is not going to happen until the kids go back to school, and that'll be nice.
One day it'll happen. One day. Mm-hmm. Now, can I talk about next week?
Well, first, just a quick question of the week.
Oh, yes.
Just let us know what is your favorite movie of 2021 so far. We are going to do our mid-year show. It's coming up. And so we would love to list sort of some of our listeners' favorite movies you've seen so far at 2021. And you, of course, can do that at themoviebreakdown@gmail.com. As well, you can find us at Twitter. At Movie Breakdown 1. We're also on Facebook, and that's also at The Movie Breakdown, so you can go there. And you're already listening to us on a podcast, obviously, but we would love it if you not just listen to us, but you subscribe us, you rate us, and you review us. And you can do that at places like Stitcher, CastBox, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Animal Music, not Animal Music, Amazon Music. So wherever you listen to your podcast, please do that. That would really help us out. It helps us expand. It helps us grow. It helps us be able to provide you with so much more. And now I'm going to let Scott do what he wants to talk about so bad.
Yeah. What I always love is when someone's career is redefined, when someone's career all of a sudden takes a new trajectory that we didn't expect. And I'll tell you this, when I was young, I thought Keanu Reeves, why would that guy from Bill and Ted's ever be in an action film? A very fast-paced action movie. Well, guess what? We're going to be looking at Speed, which was, I mean, at the time when I first saw it, this guy, what's he doing in there, and why is he doing this so well? Little did I know that Keanu Reeves would then go on to have such big action franchises like The Matrix and John Wick. So we get to be on the ground floor of a crazy career and see that first moment where he broke through as an action star.
And I think the sort of non-buff, non-beefed up, non-macho guys probably started with Bruce Willis in Die Hard. But I would say that as the 90s evolved, there ended up being a lot of that. Like, you'd see Kurt Russell, you'd see Christian Slater. Like, they would give a lot of these sort of not traditional action stars these big action movies. And I would kind of say that the influx of it may have started with this Speed and Keanu Reeves.
I think so, because it, we were coming off of, well, first of all, you had to have muscles in the 80s to be an action star. And then, you know, having karate knowledge would work. And then, well, maybe Bruce Willis sort of kicked this off before Keanu Reeves. But we got to that place where, yeah, you could have a Brad Pitt, you could have a Matt Damon, you could have a wide variety of different types of people who weren't action stars, because, I mean, prior to this, action stars were just that. They fit the mold. They did their type of film. And now, all of a sudden, bam, with Speed, we're at a point where you don't have to be of that pedigree to get in there and do a good job.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Because, yeah, there's probably a lot of people listening to this that only know Keanu Reeves as kind of an action star because of John Wick and Matrix. But, yeah, there was a time where he wasn't that. I guess he did Point Break before this, but mm-hmm. I think Point Break was more of kind of a cult hit. Well, this, I haven't done my research yet, but it had to be one of the highest grossing movies of the year.
Yeah, and this really, like, you can't, what it did for his career and what it did for kicking off Sandra Bullock's career, I mean, this movie was massive in basically setting up two people's long-term careers.
What I'm really interested in is, I know I liked it a lot in the early 90s. I know I liked it quite a bit. But as a growing movie fan at that time, I sort of had an idea of, like, well, there's these movies I like, and then there's what great movies are. And great movies had to be, like, Well, they're the ones that were nominated for Oscars, and they're the ones that are like these big dramas and have big themes. And so I sort of had an idea of like, this is what 4-star movies had to be. This is what great movies had to be. And then this one, it's something I like, but it can't be in this category because it's an action movie. I think, and I haven't seen this in a long time, I think I may learn that I've grown since then, and there's potential that next week I'm going to be declaring this a great movie.
There's a chance, right? It's interesting, and also this is directed by Jan de Bont, who did back then he did Twister, and then he did The Haunting at the end of the decade, which that's his career started off very interesting with Speed and Twister.
Yeah, we definitely have to wrap up. But is Haunting one of those movies that, well, what other words should I use, that haunt you? Like, if I think about any other movie that you constantly talk about how much you hate and how much you can't get through, like, is there many movies higher than Haunting? Maybe AI?
Yeah, I mean, this, because it was about 2 years ago that I tried to go through it again, and I didn't make it. And I think this, there's just something about this movie that I loathe. I hate the movie.
Yeah, so man, who knows, maybe we'll do some Haunting talk next week too. Probably not, because there'll be so much to talk about with Speed, as we got Dennis Hopper as a crazy man, which was not new to Speed because Blue Velvet, but all that and more. So please tune in. I think it's going to be a huge show. And if you talk about a movie that I think it's probably high on the nostalgia for some of our listeners, I have a feeling we nailed another one for next week.
I think so. So, yes, join us next week. It's going to be a blast. It's going to be an action fest. So, yes, I wow, I'm falling apart, like, instantly with the last words I'm supposed to say. Look, I'm Scott Martin, and I'm done.
You are Scott Martin, and I love you dearly. And I'm Christopher Spicer, and I love myself, too.
Take care, everybody.
Bye, everybody.